closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome once again to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm sure glad you're here. I am Todd Conklin, your loving and caring host for this episode, and I think you're going to enjoy this one, but I say that often, but I mean it this time. The rest of the time, maybe I didn't mean it. You'll have to figure out when I meant it and when I didn't mean it. September is coming to a nigh. Fall is in the air, and it's a wonderful. Busy month for me. I bet it's a busy month for you. Lots of you guys have just been slamming. And I guess that's okay. I mean, it keeps us out of jail and stuff. This podcast is interesting. It's much more medical in nature. And in fact, we're going to be talking to a physician, actually a surgeon, by the name of Dr. Eric Young. And Dr. Young is a very good person to begin our discussion of medical safety with, because Eric really has a great handle on how medical safety looks kind of across the gamut, from small private surgery centers to large, big stinking hospitals and everything in between. And I think you'll really like that part of what Eric has to talk about. Think of this one as a sorbet, an aperitif, if you will, into the discussion of patient safety and medical safety. And if you're not on this side of the equation, listen anyway, because I actually think what Eric has to say about performance, certainly performance from a surgeon and his team, has great lessons for all of us. In fact, I really enjoyed this one immensely. Lots. In fact, I'm going to talk to you after it's over because there's some things I want to talk about, but I don't want to blab it out until we have the conversation. So sit back, put your headphones in your ear holes, jog or walk or drive your vehicle or ride in a plane or whatever it is you're doing, and listen carefully to Dr. Eric Young and Patient Safety 101.
Have you done other podcasts?
No, I haven't.
So how do you guys, in the medical profession, how do you guys talk about and learn about stuff like patient safety? Is it just is it part of the curricula? Is it?
You know, it wasn't a part of the curriculum when I trained.
And you're like 900 years old.
I'm 900.
Okay, that's
old.
Good. That's
and
good.
I've been practicing forever. So when I trained, there was not a great deal of emphasis on patient safety, on drug interactions. You know, the nursing staff would catch some things, the pharmacy staff would catch some things in the hospitals, but there wasn't a tremendous emphasis on safety.
When did that start becoming interesting?
I think probably what I recall is maybe about 15 years ago, there was a big push in the orthopedic community to prevent wrong site surgery.
Right, so which is wrong, a big deal.
Wrong operations on the wrong part or the wrong patient. And so we had an initiative from our academy that they called Sign Your Site, which meant that you took a marker and initialed the appropriate area where you were going to do the surgery, on the left side or the right side, the foot, the ankle, the shoulder, the elbow.
And whatever. So it would always be a positive identification. So you would write here. You wouldn't write not here on the other side. You'd write here on the side.
You would... Initially, it was some sort of mark. It eventually evolved into your initials. And X was not acceptable because X was no, don't operate here. And so it got to be your initials. And some patients, you know, took it in their own hands and had fun with it and said,
totally.
You know, hell no.
Yeah, exactly.
On the side, they didn't want to operate it.
No tokara key.
And so that was an early orthopedic initiative. And then over time, the concept of the timeout came to be.
How effective do you think the timeout is?
I think the timeout is effective in that it basically forces the whole operating room crew to stop what they're doing for just a minute and focus on what they're going to be doing.
Right.
And make certain that everyone is in agreement. And there are a number of things that are checked off, that you identify the patient. You identify the procedure that you're going to be doing. The anesthesiologist confirms whatever type of anesthesia is being provided and also confirms whether or not the patient has received intravenous antibiotics as a preoperative measure. The scrub tech that you have also confirms that they have the appropriate instruments. And what I do, we also confirm that we have the appropriate implants for a total joint, for instance.
And is that different than, for instance, the checklist?
Well, the checklist came sort of after the timeout, and so it's added on top of the timeout. And in some cases, it has mushroomed to a ludicrous level where there can be up to, I think, 84 separate boxes that
someone kidding.
Has to check.
You're no. kidding.
No.
So, you know, Atul Gawande, the guy who sort of he wrote the checklist manifesto, surgeon, journalist, you probably know him.
Right.
He says that a checklist that's over one page, over 10 items, is not a very effective checklist.
Right.
So 84 is eight times bad.
It's similar to, I had an attending physician when I was in training who would make us repeat the dictations that we did on surgeries to make everything fit on one page. Because he said no one will ever read the second page.
Yeah, which is true, right?
And so the same thing probably applies for a checklist.
Do you read electronic charts?
Constantly.
Are they good? Are they better than the clipboard at the end of the bed?
The improvement with electronic charts is that they are accessible to everyone all the time. So whereas in the days of paper charts, if someone was working on the chart, was writing in the chart, and you were looking for the chart, you didn't have the chart.
Right.
Currently, as long as you have access to a computer, you have the chart.
How hard are they to do? Are they easily accessible?
They are. It varies. There are multiple different companies that have produced different electronic medical record systems. So some of them are much more user-friendly and much more intuitive than others. There is such a wealth of information available that there's actually probably too much information
available
to you. So there's no way that you could review everything that's in the chart without spending an inordinate amount of time.
So let's go back to these timeouts because I kind of interrupted you. Do you see the timeout as a good tool?
I do think the timeout is a good tool because it makes certain that everyone is on the same page before you start the procedure.
Is it surgeon dependent?
It should be, and it is supposed to be the surgeon who is driving.
Right, that would make sense to me.
But typically it is not the surgeon who's driving, it's the circulating nurse who reads, you know, who picks up the actual paper consent form, because not everything's electronic yet, and actually reads from that. So the surgeon by that time is usually scrubbed in.
Right.
And so they're not going to pick up.
So walk us through your day. How many surgeries, if you're in the OR, how many surgeries will you do in a day?
It varies. I basically have one day where I do inpatient surgeries, bigger cases, total joint replacements primarily. And then I have another day which is all outpatient surgeries, smaller, quicker operations. So for an inpatient day, I could do maybe five, sometimes as many as seven total joints or relatively large inpatient cases. There are people who do a lot more than that. But that's all that I really want to do.
Yeah, how many do you think is safe? I mean, that's totally an opinion. I mean, you know, who would know that answer? But where do you feel your threshold is?
Do I ever feel like we're doing something that isn't safe?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question.
Very, very rarely.
And if you did, would you stop?
Yes. And in some cases, when the anesthesiologist induces a general anesthetic, you know, you look at each other, you look at the monitors, and you're like, are we going to go ahead with this, or do we need to call this off, wake them up, and send them back out to the pre-op area and wait for a better day.
Is there pressure on you to go ahead? I mean, do you have that kind of production pressure?
I don't think that anyone feels an overwhelming amount of pressure to push through if it's going to be at a risk to the patient, at an inordinate risk to the patient. And there's always some inherent risk with the procedure. But if there's a feeling, just a gestalt that you know, this has gone beyond what really ought to be safe, then you would call it off.
I gotta love the fact that you just use the word gestalt in context in real life. You, Eric Young, are a freaking genius. It's true. It's true. What keeps patients, as a surgeon, what do you think keeps patients safest? What do you manage to create reliable outcomes in your OR?
Consistency.
Tell me more.
The absolute best case scenario for surgery is to be having a procedure from a surgeon who does that procedure all the time, working with an anesthesiologist that he works with all the time, working with a circulating nurse that he works with all the time, and a scrub tech that he works with all the time.
And how often does that best case scenario, because I'm guessing, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I can take it, I'm tough. I'm guessing that mostly that's what happens.
Not necessarily.
Oh, crap.
It happens in certain settings. In a hospital setting, you may not get the same people every time. You definitely will not get the same anesthesiologist every time because they have their own schedule.
Right, right. They rotate.
You may or may not get the same scrub tech. You probably will be working with a small number of scrub techs, and it depends on the size of the hospital, how many are in the pool. You'll be working with several different circulating nurses, and sometimes you're working with people you've never worked with before.
How much does the fact that your profession, and I really only know a couple professions that fit this, but your profession is one, they've criminalized normal human error in your profession? How much power, and the other profession I would tell you is if you're a vessel captain, a master of a vessel, and you drop oil on a duck's back in some places, you'll go to jail, yeah. Right? They criminalize that. How much does that liability influence you, the team, the OR, the hospital?
It's difficult to say. I don't think that I feel overwhelmingly influenced by a fear of culpability, of doing something wrong,
right,
and being held responsible for it. But there are so many variables involved. I mean, it's, the type of work that I do, it's very unlikely that my patient is not going to survive my surgery.
Right, right.
I would not have started the operation if I thought that was...
I think that's pretty key, right? I mean, right. I think you go in, and this is that experience and that consistency you talk about. You go in, you're going in to be successful.
Yes.
If it's not going to be successful, you're not going in.
You're not going
right?
in. And that's something that you learn, not necessarily in your training, but fairly early in your practice, that patient selection is very important to an optimal outcome. You're not going to want to do a complicated surgical procedure on a patient that will not benefit from that procedure.
How significant is the... So we always hear a lot, and a lot of people listening to this will know this. It's going to be interesting, actually. How significant is the caste system in a hospital? Are you more important than a nurse?
That's an interesting question to ask.
Sorry. And everyone's more important than the cafeteria. I'll just put that up there.
It depends on who you're asking. Okay, so to the hospital, I am probably more important to a nurse than a nurse because I am bringing patients. I am a revenue producing.
Right, patient. Income. So, and we keep score by money and all that.
And so I am probably, I'm the captain of the ship at that particular point in time.
Does a nurse feel like, you don't have to speak about yourself, but in cases historically, do nurses feel subservient? Is a nurse free and open to communicate a gestalt that this isn't going well to stop a surgeon?
A nurse would be, it's very unlikely that they would be in a position where they would have to make that call. The anesthesiologist is much more likely to be involved in telling you that things are not going well and you need to do something differently.
Right.
But over the years, even just in the course of my career, the nurses have been given more of a voice in all kinds of activities and planning. It's much easier for a nurse to basically write up a complaint against a physician or a surgeon than it was 20 years ago.
Right. It's funny because the complaint part, which I'm sure is really important, and it does get a lot of sexy value, and people talk about it. I'm really more interested in what you said earlier, which is that consistency. The fact that if you work with the same team, then there's a freedom to speak openly. Because the next question that I'm going to ask you, I think, is a really interesting question, and that is, how much near-miss learning? What do you do if something almost goes bad but doesn't?
It's a very good learning experience.
Absolutely.
When something almost goes bad, but you come back from the brink and make it right. You, as a patient, you want my day to be boring and mundane.
Absolutely. You and my airline pilot, same.
You want absolutely no excitement in my life.
Right.
But there will be times when something happens that shouldn't happen. And how you deal with that to basically get the train back on the tracks,
right,
is very important. And some of that is very dependent on the personality and the ability of the surgeon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the expert, right?
Right.
But experts have one problem, and that is they'll often go closer to the margin than a non-expert would because they're experts. And yet, if we're close to the margin, some variability's happened and something's going on. I really want a surgeon that's not afraid to go close to the margin to bring this train back onto the tracks.
And therein lies one of the problems that we see in trying to measure quality, in that a surgeon who's more experienced and somewhat more aggressive will take on patients that are more difficult,
sure,
and higher risk.
Sure.
And so your outcomes as a very experienced, seasoned surgeon may not, on paper, look as good,
right,
as they could, because you're willing to do things that other less experienced surgeons,
yeah,
will not take on.
Do you do any kind of, so let's say you have a near miss. Things go to the brink, but you recover. Everything's fine. Do you do any kind of after-action learning? Does the team huddle? Do you get together and talk about it? How do you take that information and process it so that it's a valuable learning experience for you and for the team, and eventually, I would guess, for the hospital?
I think that there are some opportunities for after-event learning, and typically it would be in a bigger case where you're working with either another physician or a physician assistant as your first assist. And, for example, if you were doing a total knee replacement or a total hip replacement or something, and you had an intraoperative fracture,
gotcha,
then you might discuss after that event with the person who was assisting you how you might have done things differently to prevent that.
Do you have time to do that?
Yes, you do definitely have time to do that.
Oh, see, that's really encouraging, and probably super important. Okay, so here's the big question. What should we be doing in order to improve really performance reliability, the opportunity for a surgeon to be successful and for the patient to be blissfully healed under the wing-like, unicorn-flavored arms, the magic fingers of a surgeon? What should we do?
Well, I think it goes back to consistency. If you put the surgeon and the patient in essentially the same environment each and every time, and you don't necessarily have to have the same crew, the same exact cast of characters each and every time, but you need to have a group of people who are educated in what you are doing and understand what you are doing and how you are doing it every time, so that the expectations are that the case basically flows the same way every time. And as we've talked about before, in my life, this happens more frequently in a surgical center environment than it happens in the hospital.
Right, right.
Because you're dealing with a smaller staff that you, chances are, you work with all the time.
Right.
And so it gets to the point where you don't even have to ask for anything. I had a surgical tech that I worked with for 10 years. And he's an outstanding surgical tech, and we would at times do an entire case without actually speaking to each other.
Wow.
Because he knew what I was doing. He was a couple of steps ahead of me all the time, and he would hand me the instruments that I needed without me asking for them.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd do a whole rotator cuff repair or something and then just look at each other and say, did we even talk during that case?
That's amazing.
Or we'd talk about something entirely different than the surgery, but we were still in sync and doing the whole procedure.
What do you think the future holds? Will medicine get better? Will we have less wrong site surgeries? Will we have less infections? Will we have less...
I think we'll have fewer wrong site surgeries. I think we'll have fewer medication interactions because there are safeguards being put in place. The challenge, I think, is to avoid overstimulus with information.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that you can really go into an electronic medical record and learn everything that's in there without being bombarded by so much other information. And there are some things that are being required to be put in the chart now that we won't go into that don't really impact me.
Right.
They are in there to check off a box that has been put in place for everything from gender sensitivity to you know, any number of other psychological factors that may or may not really impact the medical care of the patient, but someone or some group has decided this is something important that we have to include in your medical record. But you're just being bombarded by all of this information, and you get desensitized to it. So the concern is that will we miss something important because we're being inundated by so many things that are less important?
Right, absolutely. And that noise in that system, that's something to be thinking about. What do you think? Well, I don't see a time where there'll be less compliance activities for hospitals or surgery centers or even physicians to do.
I would hope that at some point it becomes a little more streamlined. Because now, rather than, you know, going hunting with a high-powered rifle, you're going hunting with a shotgun. And you're just getting blasted with multiple projectiles instead of just one. So if there's one piece of data that you need, you have to glean it out of reams of information.
Because you're an income, a revenue-producing part of the system, how much pressure is on you to actually spend the least amount of time in the things that don't produce the revenue? Like reading a chart doesn't make money, right?
Right. Reading a chart doesn't make money. It's interesting because in the course of my career, I have become less efficient because of electronic medical records. 10 or 15 years ago, before the advent of electronic medical records, I could see more patients and spend more time with individual patients because after I saw the patient, I picked up a dictaphone, I rambled on for 30 seconds, and then I went to see somebody else. Now I have to point and click and then do my dictation and do a bunch more pointing and clicking on the computer. And it's added probably 45 to 90 minutes to a full day in the clinic.
Wow. And
so it has probably reduced the number of patients that I can see by 5 to 10 a day.
Wow.
So and so that's not producing the revenue. That's not seeing the volume that you would see previously. You can still see that volume if you're getting home at 7 o'clock instead of 6 o'clock.
Yeah. That's amazing. Did we miss anything?
I don't think so.
What did you want? What were you dying to talk about that I didn't ask you? Well, if you were me, what question should I ask you?
That's an excellent question.
I'm just filled with excellent questions. I got a million excellent questions.
Well, there,
no answers, but I got a million questions.
You get really good questions. The ones that I used to get when I was younger were, how old are you and have you ever done this before?
Which I think is totally a fair question.
People have really stopped asking that question. But one of the things that has always amazed me is how little interest patients take in their own medical care. They should be asking me very good questions, and oftentimes they don't.
Is it because they're scared, or is it because they assume you know, or is it because we've built a system where they don't believe it's their role to actively sort of be a part of that care?
Well, you know, traditionally you just accepted what the doctor told you as being in your best interest. You know, for example, when I do a total joint replacement, hardly anybody ever asks me what type, what brand, what company we're going to be putting in you. And that would seemingly be very important.
Yeah, it seems like that would be interesting.
And to explain the rationale of why this is the best choice for you.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think you're onto something, because it's interesting, Eric, because I don't think people believe that's their role. I can just, for my own self, I can tell you that when I finally realized that I needed to question my dentist, right? I needed to say, no, I'm not going to come back three more times. You're going to fix it all today. And he said, okay. And I thought, well, maybe I should be more actively involved in my health care.
There are some people. I had a case the other day, and it was actually the patient's son who asked the good questions. He had gone online and educated himself a little bit about the diagnosis and the procedure, and he had some very good questions about what we were doing, how we were doing, what to expect after surgery. And a lot of times, we don't get that.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
And people, I see people who've had surgery previously, other facilities, other surgeons, and they don't remember exactly what was done or who their surgeon was or, you know, the details of their operation, which I find just mind-boggling.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that's a really important lesson, is that in many ways, what we think of as a problem that medicine has really has to start with the consumer has to be a better consumer, right, in order to create a system where medicine has to be better at providing reliable performance.
I think it's one of the fields where consumers are least informed.
Yeah.
There's a world of information out there for them, and we try to provide information for them tailored to their specific diagnosis,
right,
and their specific surgery. But, I mean, you would not go in to buy a car with as little information on board as you do to go in to plan your surgery.
Jeez. Wow. Well, that puts a nice cap on it. God. Man, this was amazing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Todd.
I appreciate it. It's really cool because it's pretty hard to get you guys to talk about this. And once we started cracking the case a little and more docs got on and more docs got on, there's a little more open, but I don't think we talk about this enough. And I think talking about it really helps us sort of understand that it's not about bad people. It's about a system that we've created that really incentivizes sort of this production mindset, and we lose things like consistency. I mean, that's a pretty easy thing to manage. Excellent work.
Well, thank you, Todd.
Pretty easy?
Yes.
It didn't kill you?
No, not at all.
You're going to be fine?
I think I'll
be okay. Good. How about a free knee replacement?
I'll see what I can do.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Peace.
So what do you think? I told you it was an interesting one. I think the whole, well, first of all, he talked about a timeout, a pre-job timeout, or a take two, or a take five, or whatever you call it in your company. Probably time to bring that into the old operational excellence language again, because I was pleased to hear him actually directly refer to that as a meaningful intervention for safety in surgery. That was pretty cool. I also thought his comment around consistency, if you think about the GEMS model and you think about performance modes, I think we were tapping into something there that when a surgeon and his team are all in skill-based or closer to skill-based than anything else, then in fact their capacity for variability is, there's a huge well full of capacity just waiting to be tapped if in fact they need to tap it. I can explain that in more detail. You probably have to call me on that one. But overall, I actually thought there was much walk across, straight across, directly coupling information from their world into our world. And I really enjoyed the conversation. We had fun. It was a fun weekend, and so we'd been together for the weekend. Eric's an old friend of mine. Not old. He's very young. But we've been friends a long time. And I asked him towards the end of the weekend if I could tease him into the podcast. Sorry the volumes weren't as consistent. I probably should have been better because I actually did it on good equipment, but I was kind of monkeying around. But I did think it was a great way It's a great introduction into some things we ought to be thinking about, and that's really what this podcast is all about. Thank you for listening and telling your friends. Keep doing it because our numbers are getting incredible. Most importantly, thanks for doing the work you're doing and for taking a couple times a week to think more about building this community that we're constantly building. Until then, you know the rules. You should learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you can possibly squeeze in the middle and end of September. I'll probably be bluegrassing when you hear this, just in case you're wondering. And until then, for goodness sakes, be safe. How about that for a nice talk with the doctor? Come on, Alan, it's your turn next.